Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. Campaigners from Iran, Mauritius, the Pacific and the Philippines will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. Governments that are brave enough to say no to US bases, the superpower suck-up in the Pacific, and Iranian people talking about their lives. Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm joined today by Mosese Wonga, an Australian-based Pacific activist. He's working with an array of organisational hats, including the Citizens Constitutional Forum in Fiji, the Pacific Island Network, and he's just been recruited to the ASEAN Leadership Project. We're going to be talking with a range of guests tonight about military bases, and the Pacific is regarded by the superpowers as extremely important for a number of reasons. The Pacific region only has a population of around 10 million people, but it forms a block of more than 20 nation states. Mosese, can we talk first about what the actual footprint of the US is in terms of bases within the Pacific? Guam is a big one, and let's talk a little bit more about Guam later on. But what's the coverage of US bases within the Pacific at the moment?
The major coverage involves Alaska, Hawaii, which is already a part of the US, and Guam. Now, they form what the Americans called the strategic triangle of the Pacific. If you have a weak link in any of those points, then their strategy in the Pacific falls apart in terms of their Pacific ability to go into other areas outside of the Pacific, Southeast Asia, North Asia, Middle East, Indian Ocean, Africa, and what have you.
So what is it exactly? They want to have striking distance for their missiles, or what is the significance of that triangle?
The significance of the triangles is a convergence of, on the one hand, the movement of hardware, people and instruments, tangible things around the ground in the field of warfare and maneuverings. And more importantly, the 21st century is the capacitation of control of space, satellite. And within this triangle lies a wonderful, unquestioned U.S. trust territory, if I may use that phrase for want of a better phrase, and that is Australia. Because that triangle is heavily dependent on a reliable, dependable physical space to mobilize it. If you look at those three, Alaska, Hawaii, and Guam, there's one specific peculiar characteristic of all of them. It's physical isolation. That means whatever happens in terms of instability in the subcontinents, they are not affected. So you get rid of all the old-fashioned warfare fears, right? Now, in terms of space, you need complementary things that go well with the triangle. That means training, where you can actually train people. That means a huge physical territory, which traditional armies need anyway. And in this case, actually, Australia provides it. And more important, you complement capacity in terms of listening devices that actually projects your power through space and then onto the specific area of warfare that you want to target.
And that's the satellite capacity.
And that's the satellite capacity. Now it's no longer confidential. In all the major wars that the U.S. has been involved in, PANGAP was used, but now actually PANGAP is not sufficient. We need other listening stations and also new training fields in the Pacific.
Certainly it's important strategically for its surveillance of the rest of the world, but it's also important for the US and other superpowers within the region. I'm thinking here of China and India, to actually secure the Pacific, isn't it? Because it's a growing area of economic, well, bonanza, really, isn't it?
According to the U.S. command and control in Hawaii, they quite blatantly say that actually this is a game of containment. And when they ask, what are they containing? They're containing actually is superpowers, China and India. So it's a new form of engagement where you make your presence, but you don't push them to the point where they become confrontational, but they become more aware of your intentions. So it's a new type of diplomacy, if you like. And if you notice that the triangle actually goes through the curvature of China and Japan all across Southeast Asia, and behind China is India.
Is that one of the reasons why China is becoming so prominent in the Pacific, that it is, in fact, nervous about the strike ability of the US because of its bases in the Pacific?
Any power who's put in China's boots definitely will be fearing the implications of the US change in strategy and power and capability. China is interested in the Pacific for two reasons. One, directly to counter those maneuvers by actually directly engaging the Pacific Island countries, the influence of the United Nations. Specifically, China is a permanent member of the Security Council. But in terms of manufacturing consent, if you like, within the majority of nation states, it still needs to get the votes. So that's one. And to complement that, actually, China needs to be seen as the benevolent new power and also to become the genuine, unwilling superpower, if you like, alienating America. So it's this play and counterplay happening within the Pacific. Mm. And that's why China is virtually interested in any country, including Virgin Islands, in the Pacific. Every country is important.
And its economic influence is enormous, isn't it? I mean, you know, certainly in terms of the United Nations and the international bodies, 20 Pacific nations presents a very formidable voting bloc. But as I understand it, China is buying up all kinds of what is regarded as useless enterprises and placing it into its stockpile.
Yeah. And also signing memorandum of understandings with governments, exchanging of personnel, training, opening up China to middle management in all of these Pacific Island states to come and see we operate. We are quite transparent. We are just like you. We are a developing country in many ways. We are not a superpower. We have a lot of similarities than differences. For example, in Fiji, the whole middle management in the government bureaucracy, you'll find actually at least one or two in all the sectors have been to China in the last 2 years. All expenses paid for. Mm. So they've built their capacity for understanding and empathy and sympathy already. It's there, it's given.
Mm. And it's so different to the American attitude, isn't it, of getting on a soapbox and getting megaphone out and kind of saying, you will, you will, you will.
It's social capital that you'll draw on, especially in times of need, when things are critical.
We're just about to go to the Mauritius and examine the fourth largest US base in the world at Diego Garcia. But as I understand it, the Guam base, which is in the Pacific, just near the Philippines, is the first largest. It's the biggest US base in the world. Can you tell me what actually happens on Guam? How big is the base and what is its importance?
Guam has the capacity to be able to host all the sensitive, high-grade weaponry that the US has its arsenal that can be moved physically. That's very hard to find a parallel to. That's why Guam, from America's point of view, is number one trustworthy base. Guam also, if you go back in history, if you look at the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they were from this Micronesian bases. The economy of Guam is basically dependent on repatriation of income of Guams in the Marines, serving actually the highest number of recruits actually from Micronesia.
Actually serving in the U.S. Army?
Yes, serving in the U.S. Army. I think since 1950, the people from Guam have been Americans and accorded that status. There's nothing produced locally in terms of real sustainable industry. It's all actually defense income. Related either domestically in terms of the people who transact locally who are there or those who are overseas sending in money, but majority of them are youth who are in the Marines who send in money to their relatives. Yeah.
And what's the population size?
160,000.
Guam people?
Guam people. The U.S. at the moment, there is a fluid movement of people. At any one time, they have no figures on how many U.S. people actually base. It's classified. But since the plan to move 8,000 of people from Okinawa to Guam, there's now being debate as to how many Guam can actually contain.
Let's go to Mauritius now to explore the case of the Chagosians, ousted from their land to make way for the fourth biggest US base situated on Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, which is south of India. Lindsay Collin is a member of LALIT, which is involved in interlinking movements to close down the base on Diego Garcia. It's also working to reunite the Republic of Mauritius and to win the right of all Chagossians to return to their land. Lindsay, tell us how the Chagossians were forced from their land in the first place.
This was one of the things that happened as Britain was withdrawing from its empire and kind of handing over and becoming a junior brother to the United States. And what they did is they cut off part of Mauritius, the Chagos Island, a number of islands, more than 100 islands, including Diego Garcia, and have ceded them to the United States. They set up a kind of fictitious state called British Indian Ocean Territories, BIOT, and then in exchange for giving it to the states, they got Polaris weapons, the submarines. So that was from between, say, 65 and 73 that this was organized. And the U.S. insisted that the islands that they would get to use as the strategic base should in fact not have any people on them. So Britain, in a really shameful bit of the British colonial history, transported all the Mauritians who had lived on Chagos away from Chagos and to Mauritius, which is 1,000 miles away.
I mean, this is an extraordinary thing, isn't it? I mean, the Russians did it in Chechnya too, just removed the population. It's an amazing thing to do. How many people are we talking about and how were they forced to leave their land?
We're talking about 2,000 people at the time, and now there'd be about 4,500 people counting the descendants of the Chagossians, who still consider themselves Chagossians. So it was 2,000 people at the time. You know, the people who lived there had contacts and families on the main Mauritian island, especially in Port Louis. So in every family, people would come back either to buy up stocks of things like, say, a new bed or pots and pans, which they didn't have on those islands, or they would come for an operation, or sometimes even for a childbirth. So when the ships would ply between the islands, and this still goes on with other Mauritian islands till now, like Gallagher and Rodrigues, people would have contacts and would come to Mauritius, to Port Louis. And what happened was when they went to go back to their homes, let's say part of a family would come here, then they were told at the place where you buy the ticket to go to the islands that the islands were closed. Just by an administrative worker in a company.
So they've left the islands and they can't return.
There's always been this idea that they wouldn't be able to go back. And so it's been a really long, long struggle. And now there's a court case waiting judgment for the right to return. It's been quite a long case because when it was first put in, there was a very good judgment from the High Court in London, even quoting from the Magna Carta from all those years ago, that the government can't just remove a population, as it were, in its own interests. So anyway, they won that case, and then the British government put new orders in council. Those are kind of queen dictates that I suppose the queen doesn't actually know about, that the government knows about it, the parliament doesn't know about it, to override the judgments. These were in turn questioned. Again, the Chagossians won their case, and then again there was an appeal which has been heard, but as far as I know, there hasn't been a judgment yet. We're expecting the judgment.
That's the appeal in February.
Yeah.
What's the likely outcome thought to be?
Well, people are beginning to think that there may be some kind of a concession where people are allowed back to some of the islands, but not to Diego Garcia itself. That's one possibility.
So tell us about why is Diego Garcia so important to the US and why is it so important for there to be people not on the island?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, actually. At the time, it was very popular geopolitically to not have people anywhere near because it was right in the middle of the anti-colonial struggles. So they thought it would be better to be behind the backs of the UN committee that looks after decolonization. So as soon as there would be a people there, they would have a right to go to the decolonization committee and there'd have to be annual reports from Britain on the state of their well-being. So they really didn't want people on any of the islands. And I suppose also, so long as people are on even some of the islands, their claim to Diego Garcia gets stronger. I think that why the islands are important, why the base is important to the US is because of its place. The Diego Garcia Island is this beautiful horseshoe-shaped island with an enormous natural harbor in the middle. Mm. So it's very sheltered. It's near the equator, so there aren't the bad effects of cyclones. And I think the most important thing is that it controls the supply of oil from the whole of the Middle East and Arabia and right across to Afghanistan.
Mm.
So I think that that's its value to the United States Armed Forces.
Indeed. It still doesn't actually explain why people shouldn't be allowed onto the island, though. I mean, certainly there were some things that people shouldn't be seeing on the island, and we've learnt recently about rendition and people being taken there for rendition during the War on Terror. Is that why, do you think?
Another one of the things they might not want people for is because there are nuclear stocks there. And this is also something that's denied a lot. But the main proof of it was when the Pelindaba Treaty for a nuclear arms-free Africa was being drafted, the U.S. and Britain insisted that dotted lines be put around Diego Garcia, which would imply that they don't want any checks there for nuclear weapons. So that's another possibility, but I really think it's to do with the danger of Mauritius claiming back Diego Garcia. The claim is so strong. And any Mauritian government that had all these years really had the gumption to fight for the reunification would have won back those islands. You know, the BIOD was made up of Mauritian and Seychelles Islands, and when the Seychelles government just claimed their islands back, they got them back. So this is really one of the weak links in the base.
The politics surrounding the return of the land to the Jagossians is very hot at the moment. For instance, I understand that some Jagossian leaders have dropped their objection to the US base now. What's the strategy here?
Well, I think one of the strategies is a kind of submission of the political strategy to a legal strategy. There's a case at the moment that the Jagossians are trying to put in through the U.S. courts for $2 million compensation for about 4,500 different people. And in order to get the right to put this case in, it's a long process, they are arguing, and they need to argue, that the case itself won't challenge U.S. foreign policy. Now, it would seem that this kind of undertaking in the legal field has spilt over into the political field. I would say a large number of Jagossians would be against the base. And certainly, I think everybody feels that the base is responsible for their forcible removal. So the stand of the leadership, it's something just in the last few years, there's been a kind of submission, I think, to the legal strategy, which is unfortunate, and I hope it changes.
Now, that's 4,500 claimants for $2 million each, is it?
It's a massive claim, isn't it?
It's huge. I'm thinking with a claim that size, too, there must be some very interesting documents coming forward about what the US policy worldwide is in terms of strategy in the Indian Ocean at the moment.
In order to defend.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Well, I think these claims have been argued in great detail by the people who've put the case in. It's two organizations plus three individuals that has been like the test case. And I mentioned that some of the people were just not allowed back to the islands, but others of the people were actually forced onto a ship. And when they were refusing to go onto the ship, all their dogs were rounded up and gassed. So, you know, some of the actions that were done in order to get the people off the islands with the full knowledge and participation of the U.S. Armed Forces as well was bordering on genocide and very cruel and inhuman treatment and lack of respect for human rights and for human beings. That's why it's so high.
The English courts have already given the Jagossians the go-ahead to reclaim their land last year, although that decision is being appealed. The American case is proceeding. I'm wondering what is actually happening to the Jagossians themselves now. I understand that some of them are living in Mauritius. In what kind of conditions are they living at the moment, Lindsay?
Well, most of the Jagossians are living in Mauritius. Some were originally left in Seychelles because they had more family links in Seychelles. But they're living, we could say, in similar sort of living conditions as poor working-class Mauritians, mainly around the capital, Port Louis. That's to say, many of them in the first years, the tragedy for them was they were people who had very good skills related to the sea. Had any kind of really well-thought-out humanitarian kind of resettlement been proposed to them or choices given to them, it's quite possible that they could have been resettled in fishing villages and things, but it was pretended that they didn't exist. And so they were just dumped in Port Louis, which is quite an urban sort of city. So they have had a lot of difficulty adapting, but a lot of the old people have died. Many of them died of what they call sadness at the loss of their islands and just being left here. But interesting that you ask that question, because since one of the British judgments, one of the concessions of the British government has been to give British passports to the Jagossians. And this has been another thing that has changed the balance of forces somewhat in the struggle for the right to return to Chagos, is that Britain is, as it were, integrating into the metropolis a part of the Jagossian community. So lots of Chagossians have been in around London now that they've got British passports. And in fact, they've been having some quite nice demonstrations, sometimes in the airports and sometimes in Crawley, I think, where they've been housed, about the right to housing, to proper housing.
I saw 400 were outside the Court of Appeal on the 5th of February too, making their presence felt. Lindsay, I'm going to bring Pacific campaigner Mo Wonga into this conversation now. Mo, is this a common story in the Pacific too? Indigenous people deprived of their land, living in squalor?
Fits the template perfectly, I'm afraid. The footprint of major powers on the one hand have got very clear strategic interests. The ecological resilience of the local environment and the issue of humanity actually is not only secondary, it's actually an afterthought. History is a testimony for that. If you look at, for example, the Pacific, a good way probably to tell the story, if you take an African who's used to oppression and very vocal to his or her human rights, and let him or her journey through some of these U.S. trust territories, they'll be totally appalled. Two reasons. One, the blatant acts of takeovers, literally the physical environment, the people, and the nation. And secondly, the somewhat passive resistance to that. And there's lots of interpretations of that and schools of thoughts of that. But that's a blatant reality. And for that reason, the U.S. is very, very sure of itself in the Pacific than any other part of the world. And this is a very important point. And because of that, U.S. is in a very advantageous position to then, for example, linking the Indian Ocean, Central Asia, for example, regards to Iraq, and the Eastern European countries, because why? It's got control of the biggest geographical region of the world.
The Pacific.
The Pacific. Mm. And if you look at all the major wars and major conflicts in history, the Pacific hasn't gone through that major upheaval, I mean, relatively speaking. So hence the phrase that the Pacific is the new frontier of the 21st century. It's very strategic.
Both of those places,
yeah.
Diego Garcia would be in reach of India and
yes.
Guam would be in reach of China.
China and India and Southeast Asia.
I'm thinking of Mururoa Atoll too, and the description of communities around there. Unemployment, massive unemployment, massive alcoholism.
Yeah. The history of decolonization in the Pacific is the worst. If you refer to all the documents of the United Nations, the major powers in the Pacific are staying put. That's France and the US are the two major ones. And because of that, it's also an invitation of others who are bold to enter the foray of possibilities. And that's basically the newcomers into the bloc, China and India. For purely economic reasons, the Pacific is potent with possibilities. In the next century, it'll be the major mining beds of minerals under the sea. That's why the law of the sea, it's been hot potatoes for the last decade.
Hmm. It's been suggested that the countries of the world are waiting for the Pacific Islands to go underwater so that they can take advantage of mining in those areas. Can I just ask Lindsay, what natural resources does Diego Garcia have? Is what Mo is saying also resonating for you too, Lindsay?
Yes, it certainly does, because we could say that the whole of Diego Garcia and the Chagos is like a continent that's partly above and partly below sea level. So it's a huge area of like banks, and those are expected to have lots of polymetallic nodules and all the other things that will be mined from out of the sea. So I think that's very, very important. The economic reasons are very clear. And then also I agree about the geostrategic positioning of the base as being important. Because apparently the U.S. is now saying that of its two main reasons for bases, the one is to control the important raw materials that they need, the sources of them and the flows of them, and the second is to control insurgency. So it's actually preparing for various kinds of rebellions in different places. And I suppose with all the new interest in Africa as well, in the U.S. they're saying 25% of their oil in the next 20 or so years will come from Africa. So there's an opening up of new bases, and then Diego Garcia is also close enough to Africa to be able to link in. But certainly I think in the history of Diego Garcia, I've always known that Guam is like this kind of twin sister of Diego Garcia in terms of military strategy. So that also resonates with me when Mo mentions that.
Mm. Just quickly, Lindsay, where can people go to read more about Diego Garcia and the plight of the Chagossians?
Well, one of the first places is to go to the Lalit website. Lalit's a political party, not an NGO. www.lalitmauritius.org. And on the homepage, there's the cover of the book. You just click on that and you get a whole lot of articles.
Fabulous. Thanks so much for joining us today, Lindsay. Lindsay Collin is a member of Lalit. Good luck with your campaign, Lindsay.
Thanks a ton. Goodbye to you and goodbye to Mo.
Bye-bye. Beautiful performance was from René LaSalle. You'll find it on his Mapu CD. We'll tell you how to access it later in the program. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Radio 3CR studios in Australia with Mo Wonga, and we're talking about US military bases around the world and campaigns to get rid of them. You know, Mo, sitting on the fence of an airbase in Manta, Ecuador, is a warning sign. Military base, no trespassing. It might as well read, Ecuadorians keep out. Since 1999, this airbase has been occupied by the United States, a forward operating location of the US military, just one of around 740 that are currently scattered in over 100 countries around the world. But not for much longer. A decision made by the Ecuador government means that the sign should come down in 2009. Herbert Dochener, from the Philippines office of the international organisation Focus on the Global South, was part of the mass movement that persuaded the government not to renew its lease on the airbase. Why was the base opposed in Ecuador, Herbert?
Well, there were many different reasons. Firstly, a lot of Ecuadorians felt the US reneged on its promise and never delivered on the supposed benefits that were promised to the Ecuadorian people, like infrastructure, added job, and all that. At another level, it was also a rejection of uses of the military bases of the United States around the world. And many people saw that in Ecuador, as in many other places, these bases are used for wars of aggression, and that make people complicit in wars of aggression that they do not approve of and that they do not want to be part of. So it was also a rejection of the wars that the U.S. are conducting through these bases.
Is it also part of that growing movement in Latin America at the moment that is developing links amongst countries there to the exclusion of the U.S.? And I'm thinking here about Venezuela, Bolivia.
Yeah, I think it's definitely part of that. But it's not just anti-American. It's really more of a rejection of the domination of the U.S. in the internal politics across and within the Latin American countries. So I think this is definitely a manifestation of that move, that shift away from the U.S. that we're seeing in Latin America. But this is also part of a larger global development in which U.S. foreign military bases are being opposed by grassroots movements, social movements, anti-war movement, wherever they are. For example, in Italy, in Vicenza, there was a very large demonstration against an expansion of a military base there. In Okinawa, in Korea, in many other places, there have been strong movements against bases for decades now. But it's only now that these anti-basis movements are actually coming together and building a community.
Well, let's take a couple of examples. Let's start in Latin America. I understand Paraguay, which one would have understood to be quite conservative in these matters, has just removed legal immunity surrounding the bases. That will be a major discouragement for the US to not have a base in Paraguay now. Can you just explain to us why, Herbert?
Well, I think part of that has to do with domestic pressure that people in Paraguay brought to bear on the Paraguayan government. Another part of that has to do with the regional environment. I think the Paraguayan government was quite conscious of how the other governments, Bolivia, the other left-leaning governments in that region, reacted to its decision to allow U.S. military presence in their country. So in a sense, it got isolated by that. And so there have been moves within the Paraguayan government to move away from providing the only U.S. military presence in that part of the world.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the U.S. holds legal immunity close. It's one of the prerequisites almost to it having a U.S. base in a country. Why is that? What is so important about legal immunity for the U.S.?
It's very important because the U.S. is afraid that locals will bring them to court for what they call official duties. And these official duties are often accompanied by abuses, human rights violations, and other acts that may be considered criminal and that the locals want accountability for. And so you have cases, for example, in the Philippines, in Japan, in Okinawa, in which people want to bring the U.S. troops to court, but they couldn't because of the legal immunity that they enjoy. In the language of the U.S. military, this is what they call force protection. According members of the U.S. military, privileges that will allow them a larger scope of action.
Force protection, but also it protects them from force. Things like rape, I understand.
They argue that this is not part of their official duty. And in the Philippines, at least, crimes like rape are supposed to be not included within the scope of the legal immunity granted to them. But the problem is, under what they call the Status of Forces Agreement that they have with the countries hosting them, these usually give them privileges that exempt them from procedures that would otherwise have been granted to ordinary citizens of the country.
Mm.
In the Philippines, for example, just to give an example, there's been a very high-profile case of a woman who was raped by a U.S. Marine who was convicted of the rape, but the U.S. Embassy insisted on securing custody of this soldier. And so this U.S. Marine, instead of being jailed in a Philippine prison, is now inside the U.S. Embassy, and the Philippine authorities have no custody over him. And this is part of the Status of Forces Agreement, that at least in their interpretation, this is how the Status of Forces Agreement should be interpreted.
And what about the rest of the world, Herbert? Places like Italy, like Okinawa, in terms of local opposition to U.S. bases?
Well, in Okinawa, there's a very vibrant grassroots-based movement against bases there. And interestingly, one of these groups, they've been going out to sea every day for the last so many months in order to prevent the construction of a new base in Henoko Bay in Okinawa. And what's interesting about Okinawa is that even mainstream or conservative governments are joining the campaign against U.S. military bases.
Mm.
And this is because of the noise, the environmental contamination, the increase in crimes, in prostitution that foreign military bases usually bring. But at the same time, I think opposition to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan also played a role and contributed to increasing people's consciousness as to the uses of these U.S. military bases. And this is also the case in Korea, where there's been a very strong anti-war movement, which has consciously tried to make the links between the existence of foreign military bases in their country and the war in Iraq. And I think that's very important. That link is very important to make, because it's important not to see the foreign military bases in isolation as just lone-standing infrastructure that just happens to be noisy or that just happens to do a lot of damage to the local community, but to see it as part of a global war machine causing a lot of death and destruction around the world and not just in their local communities.
A coalition of over 400 progressive people from all over the world came together in March in Ecuador to demand the closure of all foreign military bases worldwide. The focus is on foreign bases. Does that mean domestic military bases are okay, Herbert?
In that conference, it was decided that the focus is going to be on all foreign military bases and all other infrastructure used for wars of aggression. I think the decision to focus on foreign military bases was in recognition of the fact that all existing foreign military bases right now are used for aggression without exception, that they're used to project power, that they're used not for defensive purposes but for aggression, whether it be by the U.S., by China, by Russia, or by other countries. But there was also the recognition that 95% of all foreign military bases around the world are owned by the United States. And we all know what the United States use these military bases for. But at the same time, it was important to specify that the focus of the campaign will also include all other infrastructure used for wars of aggression, because we did not want to exclude what are considered by the U.S. as domestic military bases in places like Guam or Hawaii or Puerto Rico, where people are continuing to wage self-determination struggles and who do not see themselves as part of the United States. And we also did not want to exclude bases like the NATO bases in Europe, which are considered both foreign and domestic at the same time because they are owned by the countries in Europe. So these are technically not easily classifiable as foreign bases. So we had all these discussion on the complex configurations that bases take, and it was felt that it was important to make the distinctions.
And is the opposition just to U.S. bases, as opposed to, say, for instance, Russian or French bases?
The opposition is to all foreign military bases and all other infrastructure used for wars of aggression. And that includes bases of China in Burma, bases of Russia in Central Asia and the former Soviet Union. It includes the bases of France all over Africa. It includes all these bases. But there's a recognition that, as I said earlier, an overwhelming majority of the existing foreign military bases in the world are owned by the United States. No one comes close.
Herbert, I'm going to bring Pacific campaigner Mo Wonga into our conversation now. Mo, while the US has a big military presence in the Pacific, do China and India have any aspirations?
Yes, they do. They are not as loud as the Americans on two levels. They don't believe in megaphone diplomacy, where they shout from the hilltop. And also, they use what you can term Eastern diplomatic methods of persuasion, where it's more of direct engagement, listening to local counterpart stories, and within that, identifying the needs, how you can meet those needs. And that's something that I think the U.S. and its allies in the region have actually failed to do. Now, the Chinese and the Indians, given an example, when the coup happened in Fiji, and also further back, Solomon Islands and Australia and PNG in Australia are going through very icy relations. Both India and China, behind closed doors, have always expressed their support. They are just savvy. They are much smarter and wiser in getting influence.
Influence and to get bases in the region?
Influence to get whatever you want, whatever the agenda of the day. Now, as far as China and India is concerned, it is access to raw materials. China, for example, in Africa, is going through the speed of light and trying to access whatever they can to maintain their current level of economic growth. And in the Pacific, it's the same. In PNG, for example, everyone knows within industrial circles that China is interested with PNG resources. Now, within that matrix of economic need, when the country is actually shot through the roof in terms of economic power, it's always accompanied with redefining their military might role.
So that their economic interests are secured, actually.
Yeah, in a sense, secured. Again, I question that because actually it's a very masculine term. How do you define security?
Yes.
But that has always been the evolvement of modern states. Yeah, just for the record, it's actually very important to state that actually China, apart from the Taiwanese case, have never overtly, apart from its testing, space testing, threatened anybody. Now, compare that to the US, it's no comparison.
Mm. Could I just bring Herbert back into this conversation? Herbert, I'm just wondering, from the International Network for the Abolition of Foreign Military Bases point of view and the meeting that was held in Ecuador in March, what was talked about in relation to China and its military or strategic base ambitions?
It wasn't really talked about as a separate topic, except that there was a recognition that China does have military bases, although nowhere near as many as the U.S., and that China is also, in many respects, being used as a justification for the further stay of foreign military bases in Asia, like in Japan and in Korea and in the Philippines. Moves to introduce U.S. military presence are often designed to contain China. And in fact, the latest Quadrennial Defense Review of the U.S., which is an important policy document, has already categorically singled out China as the next and the only possible competitor to the U.S. and the only threat to the U.S.'s sole position as the world's only superpower.
Hmm. Very interesting, Herbert. We're running out of time here, but there's one issue I would like to briefly touch on with you. You're from the Philippines. The Philippines government ordered the United States out in 1991, but it's now emerging that the US has had a permanent force stationed in the South for the last 5 years. More than 800 political activists have been killed since 2001. What involvement have the US forces had, do you think, in these extrajudicial killings?
Well, first of all, their presence in the South is something that they don't want us to know about because their presence in the Philippines is very controversial. I think what they want to do is to have as little visibility as possible because at the same time, they want to stay on to be able to station themselves in that part of the Philippines which they consider as the hotbed of quote-unquote Islamic terrorism in Southeast Asia. Regarding the relationship between the U.S. presence in the Philippines and the extrajudicial killings, it may not be as direct. We do know that the U.S. military, the U.S. government, was involved in drafting the overall program of the Philippine military in its counterinsurgency war against the left here. And we do know that, and I personally believe that, there are elements within the military who are responsible for these extrajudicial killings as part of the intensifying campaign against the left, which is being seen more and more here as a threat because of their growing popularity and support among the people. We do also know that the U.S. provides over $60 million to $100 million in military aid every year for the last 5 years, and this has contributed considerably to strengthening the capacity of the Philippine military, and this has also allowed them to basically get away with human rights violations without any accountability.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the program, Herbert. I'm wondering, before you go, where can people go to read more about the International Network for the Abolition of Foreign Military Bases?
Well, they can go to the network website, which is www.no-bases.net.
That was Herbert Dochena from the Philippines office of the International Organization Focus on the Global South. Hope to speak to you again soon, Herbert.
Thank you. you so much.
Bye for now. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking about the US reliance on military bases that it's got set up around the world. We're hearing a lot from the US at the moment about the need to keep Iran and its nuclear ambitions in check. What's missing from our media, though, is what Iranians think of all this. Two-thirds of Iranians are under 30 years of age, and blogging is more popular there than almost anywhere else in the world. Our next guest, Nazrin Alavi, has been listening to what they have to say. Let's take a couple of issues, Nazrin. What are bloggers saying about the invasion of Iraq and what it means for Iran?
Pretty much what everybody else's reaction is. At first, initial reaction to the overthrow of Saddam was elation because Iranians had fought a war against Iraq for years. They'd been bombarded. Iraq had used chemical weapons against the Iranians. So they were elated that Saddam was overthrown, even though people were worried, you know, why is America doing this? Obviously, they would have preferred if it was the Iraqi people who did it themselves. But now, the Iranians are living in a pretty tough neighborhood. And it wasn't such a long time ago when the war was over. So they are scared. How would you feel if you were living in Iran right now? Exactly the same, scared, terrified.
Yes.
But, you know, the Iranians know how easily wars can start and the devastation it causes.
Much has been made of the statement reportedly made by Iran's President Ahmadinejad that Israel would be wiped off the map. As I understand it, Nazrin, that was an incorrect translation. Do young people fear aggression as a strategy for Iran, or do they favour it?
Aggression? You mean that they want to be bombed? Of course not. Why would any nation want to be bombed by another nation?
Your president's statement, as it was reported in the Western press, President Ahmadinejad said that Israel should be wiped off the map. And in fact, as I understood it, the translation was that Israel should be wiped from the pages of history, which is quite a different thing than being wiped off the map.
I mean, he wasn't actually talking about regime change. I mean, to focus too much on Ahmadinejad is to take your eye off the ball. He is no longer an important factor. He never was an important factor. Within the Iranian hierarchy, it is the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, who has absolute power. The president does not have much power. But in Iran, we've had a situation where there's just been widening gap between the rulers and the ruled. And Ahmadinejad has just been raising his hardline rhetoric, desperately trying to reassert Iran's radical credentials. But that's not the reality of Iran. And we saw recently that only after 18 months in power, there was a huge voters' backlash against him. People don't support him. He was elected on an economic platform, and he will be judged. So he is the guy who came in and said, I am going to bring oil money to the tables in Iran, and I'm going to share oil money with the people. And that hasn't happened. All we've had is inflation, and he's no longer a factor.
Mm. One of the issues that people from the West don't understand is the nuclear issue in Iran and how important nuclear power is for the people of Iran. Can you take us through what people in Iran are saying about the building of nuclear power stations and perhaps the confusion they are facing in terms of the very hostile response from outside?
As far as most Iranians are concerned, it is a peaceful energy program. What we're hearing a lot, not ordinary people, but people within the ruling elite in Iran, is that they don't want to go over war over this.
Mm. What is the pressure for power in Iran at the moment? In a very practical sense, what is the need for these power stations at the moment?
Well, Iran has 70 million population, and oil is not going to be indefinitely there. And this has been going on since before the revolution, Iran's nuclear program. Even the United Kingdom, that has oil, voted to go in and develop nuclear sites.
The parents of the 20 and 30-year-olds in Iran at the moment were young themselves through the Islamic Revolution in 1979. They fought an 8-year war with Iraq. Europe and the US keep on talking about the need to bring democracy to Iran, whatever that means. What kind of government would young people in Iran like to see at the moment?
Let's focus on the student population. At the beginning of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini basically set up Tahrim-e Vahdat, which is the largest nationwide student union. The purpose of setting up Tahrim-e Vahdat was to push out left-wing groups, liberal groups from campuses. But what happened a quarter of a century later, Tahrim-e Vahdat, which was set up to endorse the rule of the revolution, has become a pro-democracy union. And recently we've seen that their election results have been nullified. Tahrim-e Vahdat student union leaders have been arrested. You know, what the revolutionaries have to come to terms with is that the children of the revolution have different ideals to Khomeini. And we're seeing that. You can't just, you know, Tahrim-e Vahdat gained its legitimacy at the beginning of the revolution. Okay, they were bullying lecturers, they were bullying other groups and intimidating other groups initially, but now they were getting voted in. They got their legitimacy from the votes of the students' body. Tahrim-e Vahdat has evolved into a pro-democracy group, and the students of the country are voting for pro-democracy leaders. What they're doing is they're closing down, you know, student union. They just cancelled elections. You can't just say this doesn't exist. It exists. These are the children of the revolution, and they have different views to their forefathers. Iran has one of the youngest and educated populations in the Middle East. You can't just educate people and expect them to behave a certain way, an indoctrinated way. I was talking to somebody yesterday. They're saying that the Ministry of Culture, they have these offices where they censor books. And he was telling me that they take on graduates to read books and to underline the things that they find objectionable. But they have a huge turnover because after a while, these censors who work in this section are won over by the text they read. They don't find them objectionable anymore. It opens their mind. Yes. So they end up sacking people.
Yes.
Because this person has read so many books that within the red lines of the regime are unacceptable. But gradually, he is won over by these texts.
Yes. This
is... information is power, is empowering. And these youth have been empowered by being given a very good education.
Yes, and that means, I suppose, that there is a push inside the country that should be left to evolve itself, that there are people...
Oh, certainly.
Yes.
Yeah, and there is so much change. Iranian society is evolving all the time. Iran has hundreds of thousands of bloggers. Reporters Sans Frontières calls Iran the biggest prison for journalists in the Middle East. But that also indicates a dynamic, progressive society where large numbers of Iranians are willing to stand up for their rights and raise their voice in the debate about their country's future. Recently, there was a student protest in Iran, and one of the student leaders gave a very well-received speech, and he said our struggle is twofold, against internal oppression and external foreign threats. You know, people in Iran, they feel oppressed by their own leaders and bullied by outside forces at the moment. The new internationalist, the March issue, there was a translation of a brilliant article by Nushin Ahmadi Khorasani.
Wonderful.
She's a women activist. While the article was coming out, unfortunately, Nushin was arrested. And the day before their arrest, these women activists, they put out a letter basically to state their position. What they were saying in the letter as well is saying that the pressure on us in twofold. We are witnessing decisions being made on our behalf without our presence or the presence of our legitimate leaders, where at the other end, we feel the circle of siege around us increasingly tightened as we are threatened with sanctions and the nightmare of war. So the Iranian society is under a lot of pressure right now. And any sort of attack with Iran would only save the radicals. Because when you are attacked, your natural instinct is to fall behind your leaders in face of a greater enemy.
Nazrin, we're running out of time quickly here. I want to bring Moses Awonga into the conversation. Mo, are you feeling that you want to contribute in any way from any perspective from the Pacific on what Nazrin has been talking about?
I find Nazrin's stories about activism in Iran fascinating, especially the fact that 2/3 of the student populations are females, are women. and also the young demographics right across the nation. And that's very Pacific. The most active people within terms of engaging community and raising issues are women. Anyway, I just find it fascinating that they have these universalities.
Absolutely. Can I ask you, Nazrin, is that what you're finding too? There are factors in Iran at the moment that might be holding women's voices down. How important is women's voice within Iran at the moment for peace?
Recently, we had the arrest of 33 Iranian women activists. One of the women arrested, she wrote in her blog, "The women's movement cannot be stopped by our arrest. The women's movement is out there in society by every female who feels they are being discriminated against and feels that they have to act against it." I agree with Moses. I mean, if we just look at the 20th century, baby boomers in the West have had enormous impact, driving change and transforming across the Western world. There is a huge possibility that Iran's new up-and-coming youth may well prove just as significant and influential for their society. But right now, that's a big might as things stand, because we are facing a countdown to confrontation between the West and Iran. And we may yet again see a destruction of another Iranian generation like we saw in the war with Iraq.
That's a very powerful point, Nazrin, as was the discussion that we've just had now. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I'm sorry, I get a bit overexcited when people talk about war in Iran.
Thank you so much for such a spirited rendition of the perspectives that we are so poorly missing within media outside Iran at the moment.
Thank you for giving me the time. Bye-bye.
That was Nazrin Alavi, the author of We Are Iran, published by Portobello Books. You can read more from her in the March edition of New Internationalist magazine, Inside Iran. And Nazrin is the final guest on this week's Radio New Internationalist, so it's time to say goodbye. The co-producer of today's program is Rachel Maher. Thanks, Rachel. And thanks to tonight's co-host, Mozese Wonga, who's worn many organisational hats today. You're an active activist indeed, Mo. It was great talking with you. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today we feature the Mapu CD, performed by one of our favourite artists at the moment, René LaSalle. The CD's musical reaches wide, incorporating African, Indian, Madagascan and European influences. Our theme song also comes from a performance by René LaSalle, who combines with Bob Gosman on the Dig Dig CD. You'll find both of them on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find copies of this program, just waiting to be downloaded onto a computer or iPod near you. Chris Richards. Let's talk again next week.